Welcome to episode four of Kawasaki Dreaming. I'm your co-host here, Mike. I just want to thank everyone who's reached out to me again, all the positive tweets. I've had some issues the last month. I've been hospitalized twice, and I'm actually doing this podcast live from my hospital bed right now. So I'm hoping to be home next week. I'm hoping that my next podcast will be from my house. So it's good to be back on here, and we're going to talk FMW. We're going to talk some Mike Awesome. We're going to talk some freedom things today. And I just want to introduce Mr. Brett Bahu, and he can kind of tell you about himself a little bit.
Yeah, I've been doing, I've been covering FMW for the last 20 years, just everything that has to do with FMW, the follow-up promotions, which includes, some people don't know, Freedoms is a, promotion pretty much that came from FMW, or the promotions that came from FMW eventually. But yeah, I've been covering this for 20 years and following everything with all the wrestlers and stuff. So, glad to be on.
Awesome. I'm glad to be doing this again. I enjoy digging into FMW in Japan. I'm a big wrestling fan in general, you know, all kinds of wrestling. So today we're going to talk about Mike Awesome just a little bit. Mike Awesome was one of my favorite wrestlers. I thought him and Tanaka's whole series was amazing. I actually had the pleasure of having dinner with Mike Awesome and Jeff Jones in Salem, New Hampshire years ago. There was a TV taping. We all stayed in some hotel. We got talking, and I bought him a beer at the bar, and we actually sat down with two of them gentlemen and a friend of mine. We had a nice dinner, talked about wrestling and things, and I was very sad when Mike left us. I thought he was the most underutilized wrestler. WWE and WCW were absolute idiots. You know, this guy was a monster, and ECW, Heyman booked him amazingly. He had a great run there. He had a great run in FMW. Just could do amazing things for a big man. Absolute amazing things. So, just to talk with you, and you know, and this is lead for both of us, you know, thoughts on Mike Awesome before he was in FMW. Obviously, he did some jobbering stuff in WCW. He had a run in Florida, and he had a quick program in Memphis too. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, the only thing I've seen is the Florida stuff, and I mean, he's just really green there. I mean, I think you can see potential, but there's nothing like you need to seek this out or anything like that. I mean, like I said, he was green. There was potential, but there's nothing like, wow, this is such a great performance, or this is a great match or anything like that, at least from what I've seen, which isn't that much. But again, I've only seen the Florida stuff. I might have seen like one or two matches from Memphis long, long time ago. But the only thing off the top of my head I really remember is the Florida stuff.
Yeah, I remember him being a jobber doing like WCW Saturday Night, mm-hmm. and he did a few of those, and he had a great look back then. When I first saw him, I remember him like putting people over like Tom Zink, and I remember he had a match with Rock Hard Rick and Steiners, you know, and they're just squash matches. But I said, man, look at this big guy, and obviously he had his run in PWF from Florida, where he was kind of a mid card guy. You know, him and Dennis Knight had a feud, who would go on to be Midian, and they kind of went back and forth, and never, you know, nothing amazingly huge there. You know, he'd, you know, wrestle Kendall Windham and lose to him, and he'd wrestle guys like Rod Slinker. He'd occasionally go over to bottom talent, like some of the Bodyguard Mike and some of the jobber guys. When he went to Memphis, I have most of the Memphis TV, and he actually had an interesting feud with Jerry Lawler there. You know, they wrestled in some tag matches and singles matches. You know, Awesome had teamed up with Bill Dundee and Chris Champion. Actually, at the time, Lawler was a heel, and Awesome was a face. So he did pretty well there over mid-card guys. You know, he beat Chris Champion and Lou Winston. Most of his singles matches, except for the singles matches with Lawler, he won. So he had a nice little run there. He wasn't there a long time. He started out there in March of 1990, and eventually he lost the Loser Leaves Town match to Chris Champion in the end of May. So he was there for about 2 months. But, you know, his little program at Lawler was cool. And he did a little thing with Chris Champion at the end. And, you know, he'd do a few more things in PWF. And then we would kind of send him over to your expertise. You know, what were the initial thoughts of on Awesome by the FMW office kind of when he brought him over? And obviously, it was probably through the Florida deal, I would assume.
Yes, well, what happened was they were going to bring in a guy named Al Green. He was going to be the Gladiator. And so, but then Al Green, and some might remember Al Green from WCW, like 98 or so. I remember he lost, he was one of the guys that got squashed by Goldberg. But anyway, so he was originally supposed to come in. Well, he ended up canceling at the last minute. And like you said, it was through the Florida deal of bringing in foreigners. And so they brought in Mike Awesome in 1990. And I mean, it was really going to be just a one off type thing, one tour. And but they were really impressed with him. Just what he, how agile he was, and you know, just his look and everything. Onita was really high on him, and so they kept bringing him back over and over. I mean, he was there, he went pretty much was there for over 7 years. So I mean, he was the most successful foreigner that FMW ever had, and I mean, just right from the start, they were really high on him because of just what he was capable of doing.
Yeah, and people remember too. I think this is probably why, but at that time, Al Green actually went to WCW and did the Master Blaster gimmick with a very young Kevin Nash.
Yeah.
They were that tag team who had a little success. I mean, they won an initial Clash of Champions card, and then eventually the Steiners beat them, and they kind of rode off into the sunset, brought another Blaster in. But that's probably around the same time. And ironically, too, Mike Awesome's last match in Florida before he did go to FMW was against Al Green.
No.
So it's kind of ironically, but yeah, definitely amazing talent, and probably right around that same time. You know, I talk about always looking at your best matches. What are your best Mike Awesome matches, you think, over those 7 years, like maybe five or, you know, matches? You thought that, would you really, if someone had really not seen Mike Awesome, what were five FMW matches you tell them to go watch?
I'd say, well, number one would be the Tanaka match at Kawasaki Stadium on September 28th, 1997. That's kind of what led to the whole ECW feud. You know, that was the pretty much over the course of a couple of years, you know, Mike Awesome and Masato Tanaka were feuding in FMW. Not necessarily feuding, but it was more of just whenever they faced off against each other, Tanaka would pretty much kick Tanaka's Gladiator would kick Tanaka's ass. And then in February 97, Tanaka challenged for the double FMW double titles, and Mike Awesome won, and he sent him through a table in the process of winning. Well, then Tanaka got another match, got a rematch at Kawasaki Stadium, and in this match, Tanaka gets his revenge by countering, pretty much, you know, doing the counter of pick, instead of getting thrown through the table, Tanaka picks up Awesome and throws him through the table. So Paul Heyman sees that and goes, oh, that we can make money off that. You know, I want to, you know, and he was high on Tanaka already, and, you know, and bringing in Mike Awesome. And so, you know, that's what really set up the, you know, they kind of booked that for the Heat Wave 98 match, where just those key spots, they were going to do the same thing. And then that kind of, you know, hey, that was really hot, Heat Wave 98. And then, you know, Awesome got hurt in 90, you know, leading into 99, and Heyman pretty much going, hey, you know, Taz was leaving and stuff. We could put the belt on Awesome. He can have these awesome matches with Tanaka because, hey, he had an awesome match with Heat Wave 98 and just the whole summer of 98 feud with Tanaka. Well, that all predate, you know, was all started because of the FMW Kawasaki Stadium match with Tanaka. So that's always the top one. Some other matches, Hayabusa on September 26, 1995. That's the Grand Slam tournament final. There's a match also on that tour in that tournament against Hayabusa. And I wouldn't say it's the by any means a good, even, you know, a really good match or anything like that on September 5th. But there's a warm spot in my heart for the September 5th match in Sapporo. And like I said, it's not something like, oh, seek this out, it's so great. But there's just, it's kind of really the proof of like, hey, these guys are on top and, you know, the new FMW is here. So that always has a spot in my heart. But the September 26th match, just 3 weeks later at Corrigan Hall, the finals of the tournament, that's a good match, 26 minutes or so. And, you know, I mean, you can see Mike Awesome doing mat work and everything, and then leading up, building to the spots. And eventually Awesome hits the Kamikaze Awesome Bomb off the top rope on Hayabusa and defeats him for the title to win the vacant Brass Knuckles title. Another match, it's a tag match. It's Terry Funk and Mike Awesome against Hayabusa and Masato Tanaka on September 24th, 1996. This was, you know, I mean, it just 96 FMW brawls are so great. The crowd's all into it. This is probably like the peak of the new FMW and just how hot the crowd is. And, you know, they're brawling all over the building and at Corrigan Hall. And, you know, just Mike Awesome hits the Kamikaze Awesome Bomb on Masato Tanaka and ends up getting a win. That's just one of my favorite matches in general. Another match is against Wing Kanemura on December 11th, 1996 at Komazawa. Early on, this is for like to merge the brass knuckles and the independent title that the independent title which Kanemura had at the time, and Awesome had the brass knuckles. This right away, like Awesome is ends up getting his leg caught on the in the middle rope. And you think, oh, man, this is going to be disaster. You know, it's like a botch right away. Awesome screws up. Well, they really use that to their advantage. And, you know, Kanemura is going after Awesome's knee and leg the whole match. And it's just, and again, there's another, like, table spot where Awesome throws Kanemura through the table. So that's another Awesome match. You know, eventually Awesome would end up getting the win and merging, you know, and it would become the FMW double title. So. Those are like my favorite Mike Awesome matches. I'm trying to think of really anything else. I mean, I wouldn't even say it was my, you know, top five or whatever, but it's a fun match. Is Mike Awesome, Super Leather, or sorry, Mike Awesome, Hizagatsuoi, and Horace Boulder against Super Leather and the Headhunters at Kawasaki Stadium, May 5th, 1996. And, you know, and it's just another one of those wild brawls. Sticks out. I mean, I think it helps that it's Kawasaki Stadium and they're able to brawl around the stadium and stuff. So those are, I would say, top five matches out just kind of off the top of my head. I mean, he had some more, he had a couple other matches with Hayabusa. I wouldn't necessarily rate them high or recommend them, but, you know, there's a soft spot in my heart for all those matches. And so I think that's pretty much it off the top of my head. I mean, the Masato Tanaka match in February 97 that originally, like I said, it was for the double titles. I mean, it's a good match, too, if you I would recommend checking out as well.
Why do you think the two of them gel so well together?
Well, Masato Tanaka was just willing to take whatever he could give, and it's just kind of this understanding. You know, they were friends. They could understand, hey, you can hit me as hard as you want. I'm going to hit you as hard as I can. You know, that kind of relationship kind of bonded them. And so I think just Awesome, you know, felt comfortable with Masato Tanaka. They're like, hey, I can beat the crap out of Tanaka, and he's good with it. You know, I mean, even like Hayabusa, you know, and Awesome obviously had really good matches with Hayabusa, but, you know, it was a completely different style. Like, you know, I don't think Mike Awesome felt comfortable of, I can just beat the crap out of Hayabusa like I can Masato Tanaka. You know, just stuff like that. I think just that comfort level, and he's willing to take what I can give and just make me look good, and so I'm going to make him look good in return. And, you know, I think Kanemura also kind of provided that as well with Awesome. But I mean, no one really liked Tanaka, and I mean, it just shows why their feud and their rivalry is going to be remembered 20 years from now, like it has been the last 20 years.
Yep, absolutely. And you talked about how, you know, Heyman wanted to bring Awesome in after seeing that match. Why did Awesome stop working for FMW? And initially, was FMW just lending him to ECW, or was it known that he was going to be done with FMW?
Yeah. So, well, what happened was, you know, the FMW and ECW had a talent relationship at that time, and Masato Tanaka came over to ECW, and Heyman wanted Mike Awesome to also come in, and so FMW, you know, and Awesome had came in obviously prior to that. I know he wrestled in 94, the line was crossed against JT Smith, and then I believe he toured for a little while in 97 while he was off tours, and that was the thing, like, okay, while Awesome is off the tour of FMW, you know, when the tour's not running and he's on a break and he's back in America, hey, he's going to come over to wrestle in ECW, and FMW is fine with that. You know, they've been fine with it before, whatever, but he was going to obviously have more of a kind of a push, and there was going to be more meaning to it because he's now fighting against Masato Tanaka in meaningful matches. The 97 matches were really nothing, just mid, you know, undercard matches really that were, and then like the JT Smith match was memorable, but for all the wrong reasons, but, you know, now it was like, okay, we're going to make him actually, you know, we have a future with this guy. We're going to keep him, you know, push him, and we're going to work a program. And like his first real program was against Tanaka in 98. You know, I know they had a match, Jerry Lynn and Masato Tanaka against Just Incredible, Mike Awesome in Queens in 98, you know, stuff like that. And they had several matches before the Heat Wave match. Well, you know, around this time period, Mike Awesome was kind of, you know, FMW was changing. FMW, the entertainment style. Actually, I take that. Sorry, I'm going a little ahead of myself. So he ended up getting injured. He injured himself twice. In FMW, you know, he hurt his knee against Super Leather in August 98. Well, then in September 98, he had a match in ECW against Balls Mahoney. I think he like blew his knee out doing a baseball slide. And like I said, he had already injured it a month prior against Super Leather and FMW. Well, this one, when he blew his knee out against Balls Mahoney, he was out for a year. I mean, he was out for a complete year. So by the time that he he came back in 99, a year later, and he, you know, states that he, you know, just felt like he didn't have loyalty to this new FMW. The promotion changed, you know, just the whole Fuyuki Entertainment Pro Wrestling at this point. Right. You know, he didn't feel the loyalty. He didn't feel like he needed to, you know, continue to work here. It wasn't the same FMW to him, just, you know, just with management change and everything by the time that he was ready to go in 99. And then also, I mean, if you really look at it, in 98, Mike Awesome, the Gladiator, and FMW was getting pushed down the card completely. He really did not have a meaningful match. You know, after the Masato Tanaka match, September 97, he joined Zen, and, you know, he had some tag matches with Super Leather and stuff like that, but he was not on the main card, or, you know, he wasn't main eventing anymore after that. He ended up making the finals of a tournament to determine for the double titles, and he fought Hayabusa at Corrigan Hall, the main event, at March 17th, 1998. Hayabusa wins the match, kind of like ending their three-year feud pretty much. And after that, Mike Awesome is pushed down the card to where he is just beating jobbers at this point. He's beating all the young boys, the future Mama Sasaki, Nahiko Yamazaki, Mr. Pogo number two, just squashing guys, and everything. So there really was no like, hey, Mike Awesome's the future. Mike Awesome's, you know, gonna have a main event spot here. I mean, so anyway, so he ends up, you know, injuring his knee and everything. He's out for a year. He decides he was gonna work for All Japan instead. And so he works for All Japan, and he works a tour there around August, September 99. And, you know, he has a match against Kenta Kobashi that he loved. And then afterwards, it's, you know, ECW comes a call in, and it's like, you know, hey, we're going to make you our champion and all that. And, you know, he probably would have made more money in All Japan. I'm guessing probably a lot more. But, you know, he decided, you know, okay, it's time to move to the, you know, it's easier to just travel in the States and everything. And, you know, it's not like he really had loyalty to All Japan. He just worked a tour there. So, you know, I mean, like I said, Heyman's offering, I'm going to give you the title. You can have this feud with Masato Tanaka. You know, you're going to be the top guy, all that. You can travel in America instead of Japan. You could, you know, after a weekend, you can stay at home, stuff like that. You know, so I'm sure all that had to do with, you know, making decision to go to ECW. So like I said, he actually left FMW technically for All Japan. There was just a 1 year gap, and he only stayed in All Japan for a month.
Right. Yeah, the Kobayashi match was amazing. When he went to ECW in 94, he did a couple TV matches, too, right around the J.T. Smith angle. They had him beat Keith Shahir and Mikey Whipwreck. Then he actually had a pretty good match with Sabu in Philly, too, at that time. If anyone pulls up your ECW archives on ECW TV, episode 50, Mike Awesome and Sabu go about 15 minutes in the arena. It was a pretty cool match. So if anybody out there wants to check out that, too, that was kind of the program with him there. And obviously, JT, that whole match was didn't help him any. But
I was watching the network a couple months ago. I didn't even know this match happened. It was on Hardcore TV in 2000, Kanemura versus the Sandman. Yep. Did not know that match existed until a couple months ago. But they had that was a match that happened.
Yeah, there's some gems if you look in there. There's some gems. I've had even before there was a network, I have I have an external hard drive that's got every ECW commercial release, TV episode, pay-per-view, and not all the fan cams, but I would say all the fan cams that released 10 years or previous.
Yeah.
So about 200 episodes of the fan cam. So, yeah, it's like my holy Bible of ECW. Yeah, so I go back into it and watch it.
Well, I'm sure that's a lot better than the network, because that's the one thing about the network. I mean, I watched a lot of ECW in 97 or so, and obviously, but now watching it back on the network, or even a lot of what I would do is watch it on WWE 24/7. I actually like that more. I like that on-demand service better than the network personally, but, you know, just the, and it's the complaint that everyone has, just the editing and the music, and I don't know.
Absolutely. A lot of censoring. I went to some of the ECW shows too. I like to look back and just see the shows, and sometimes I can see myself in the crowd. And I remember a show in Poughkeepsie where Taz and Sabu were in the crowd, and he went to hit Sabu, and Sabu moves, and I kind of got hit. So it's kind of a cool, kind of a cool thing. And yeah, definitely, it was like an experience. ECW. I always tell people I still miss it today. I went to at least 57 shows. I lose track sometimes. I might have been a few more than that. But,
you know, I feel like there's the same kind of nostalgia for ECW that there is for FMW, really. Like, it's, you know, and they both kind of were around the same time, obviously, and both have the same, you know, type of style that they're remembered for and everything. But, you know, and I was talking to Ricky Fuji this like 5 years ago or so, and he was like, yeah, you know, there's this subculture of wanting FMW back. You know, it's, there's more fan events, more, bring it back type things. And, you know, I mean, obviously brought it, the Super FMW, Super Battle FMW promotion came, you know, and everything. But, I kind of feel like it was the same thing just a little bit later. Whereas with ECW, you know, with the Vince bringing it back and obviously not good. And, you know, but like, you know, when that DVD came out in 04, I mean, and, you know, One Night Stand in 05, like there was a fan base for it. And I mean, I think they've kind of killed it here over the last couple of years, and where now no one wants it, you know, or it's not being cried, you know, and people aren't crying for it anymore. But I feel like there was the same kind of thing with FMW where like, hey, we miss it. We want it back, just like ECW.
Oh, sure. Well, the thing, too, is the first One Night Stand was okay. I mean, Sabu and Rey Mysterio was a great match. I actually even enjoyed Sabu and Cena. You know, Van Damme winning the title. You know, it was okay, but then they just they booked it to shit. And I don't think they should have made it a touring entity. It just, you can't recreate it. And maybe occasional shows here or there, or like an angle against them. They probably could have bled that for 6 months.
Yeah, no, I remember thinking, like, I mean, the sci-fi, we're obviously talking about the sci-fi one, but, like, I remember thinking, like, oh, you know, I mean, just even, they just bring back, like, the cutaway interviews that they did in ECW at the end, like, just something like that, make it at least somewhat feel like, you know, an ECW, and they didn't do that, and I just remember, like, oh, like, after first episode going, all right, this isn't going to work, and then by episode two or three, it was like, okay, this is definitely not working.
Yeah, most definitely. It was not good. It was not good at all. It just kind of tarnished it. But, like I said, it is what it is. Now, the interesting thing is, Onita and Mike Awesome are involved in 130 matches together, tag matches. They never had a singles match. Why?
They actually did. It was actually on, it was actually the first tour that Mike Awesome did. Okay. So, it was on October 1st, 1990. And so what it was, like I said, you know, they brought Mike Awesome in, and the original plan was just, he was going to just tour, and he was going to, you know, and that's what they were doing. They're bringing in a foreign guy, a big foreign guy, and he was going to job to Onita at the end of the tour. That's what they did to Mongolian Mahler. Yeah. They had done that earlier in the year, just bring him in for the end of the tour, and then Onita beat you, and you're gone. Bye-bye. But they, like I said, they really liked Mike Awesome, and so they, you know, after he lost to, it was a chain match. He hadn't even started wearing the makeup yet or anything. So he was just his face. And, You know, and so there, yeah, so they had a match, and then that's when, you know, Onita was like, you know, this guy's got, I like this guy, let's keep bringing him back, and so they kept bringing him back after that. Now, the whole reason why they had a million matches, you know, tag matches and stuff following it was literally just because, like, hey, we don't, you know, obviously with Japan, and, you know, they're not going to have that many singles matches. They're going to save the singles matches for the bigger things. Well, the thing with Mike Awesome is they never really pushed him as the top guy. You know, his real big push came in after Onita retired, and then the whole Hayabusa Mike Awesome feud in 95. With when Mike Awesome was there, it was always Mike Awesome's going to be like the number two guy. And so for the most part, it was with Mr. Pogo. I mean, there was obviously, I think he was injured for most of the Tiger Jeet Singh feud. But, you know, like even like Riki Fuji was a top heel there for a little while, like Team Canada. So it was like Big Titan, Mike Awesome, Riki Fuji, stuff like that. They never really made Mike Awesome like the number one heel. Like I said, but mostly it was Mr. Pogo. And that's really where, I mean, where they made a lot of their money was just the standard six man. And I did translation results of from all these magazines from, you know, the 90s and stuff. And I can just, it's just the, I can just I can't count how many times I wrote down Atsushi Onita and Mr. Ganosuke and either Sambo Asako or Katsutoshi Niyama defeated Mr. Pogo, the Gladiator, and Hideki Osaka when Onita pinned Osaka in a barbed wire street fight. You know, like that was the match. They just kept doing that over and over. So because why, you know, hey, why have, we're making money, we can just have a six man and all that, and we can just have Onita pin Hosaka each time. There's no reason to beat Mike Awesome. There's no reason to beat Pogo unless we're going to have a big program, you know, a big main event program or like a big show or something like that. And if it's going to be a big show, it's going to be Onita versus Pogo. So that's pretty much why they had so many tag matches. But yeah, they had one right away and then never did it again.
Now, what were your this is kind of off script, but what were your thoughts on Big Titan? Obviously, he went on to do some stuff with New Japan, and he did some stuff in WWE. Kind of, what were your thoughts on him and him kind of not making it bigger?
You know, I think he gets a really bad rap for the fake Razor Ramon gimmick. I mean, I think he was almost as good as Mike Awesome around that time period. Now, I mean, he could do the high flying moves. Now, not as good, and you know, but. I mean, he had a great look, and it's actually kind of scary, you know, how he looks like this monster in FMW, and, you know, he's got the blonde mohawk and stuff, but nobody thinks of him, you know, as any monster as the fake Razor Ramon in WWF and stuff like that. But, I mean, you look at Big Titan, you look at that, you know, 1993, 1994 look, that he looks like a monster as well as the Gladiator. He looks just as intimidating. You know, like I said, I mean, and he definitely had some skills and potential. Now, like I said, you know, obviously not as much as Mike Awesome. Mike Awesome was had more talent and had more skill. But, I mean, I do think he gets a bad rep. You know, I've listened to some interviews he's had. He did a lot of interviews afterwards. He became a public speaker around, like, 2010 or so. I don't think he's doing it anymore. But around that time period, he was willing to talk about everything, just life on the road and stuff. And, you know, he came off as a really good guy. And, I mean, I feel bad for him, you know, that, hey, like, a two-month gimmick, I mean, I guess 3 or 4 month gimmick is how he's really remembered for, you know, as this joke or whatever, when, you know, I mean, he had a success, I would consider his FMW run successful. You know, he went to war afterwards, I wouldn't consider that successful or anything, but, you know, he was with FMW for a couple of years, and I would consider it a successful time, and, you know, I mean, he, like I said, he was pushed just as high as Mike Awesome. They had a feud and they traded wins type and everything. So I don't know. I think he gets a bad rep. I actually watched him also in Memphis. You were talking about Memphis in 1990. I caught Memphis at the very end, like 1997 was when I live in Louisiana, and we got Memphis wrestling on Saturday nights. And so I was able to watch the very end of USWA, and there he was, you know, he came in as the fake Razor originally, and I think he changed it to Rick Titan afterwards. And, you know, he had a feud with Glenn Jacobs, who later became Doomsday and stuff like that. So, I mean, I watched him there. That was actually, you know, how I actually, before getting into FMW and stuff, that's how I remembered him more, you know, from USWA than WWF a little while, you know, earlier, since he was only in WWF for like 3 or 4 months.
Right.
Oh, you're low. You're very low.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Then he did a little bit of stuff with New Japan for a while too, but
yeah, I didn't watch any of that. I didn't watch too much New Japan in 1998 or so. I didn't watch too much of that.
Now, who came up with the Gladiator gimmick? Was that just something the office shot out there? Or?
Yeah, like I said, it was going to be Al Green's gimmick. Yeah, so it was literally just, hey, we're not going to call you Al Green. We're going to give you a name, make you seem like you have value. And it's just to kind of build him up. And then when he pulled out, it was like, okay, well, Mike Awesome, you're going to get this name instead. And so, it really wasn't even too much of a gimmick. It was just a name. And then Mike Awesome kind of, he made the difference of, okay, the Gladiator wears face paint. Like I said, the first tour, he didn't wear face paint. But after a while, him and Titan, when Titan came in and, they both started painting their face to look more ferocious. And I think that was the thing Onita told Awesome, hey, we want you to look mean. And, you look like, you don't look mean enough in the face. You need to wear face paint. And so he started wearing the face paint. And, that became the Gladiator wearing the face paint. Whereas Mike Awesome, whenever he wrestled as Mike Awesome in America, he didn't wear the face paint. So there's that difference right there. The Gladiator wore face paint and Mike Awesome did not.
Right. Okay, let's fast forward a little bit. Obviously, Masoka was just injured in GCW. Freedoms really doesn't have a very in-depth lineup. It doesn't have a lot of guys right now. Obviously, Kasai's have some injuries. How do you feel that Masoka's injury is going to impact Freedoms?
And before I say this, I want to just say, obviously Freedoms has a thin roster, so any injury is going to hurt them just because, hey, he's a value name. But I actually think this is probably, if he's going to have an injury as bad as he did and stuff, this was probably like almost the best timing. The only probably thing was the fact that they had just vacated the King of Freedoms tag titles, him and Violento Jack. They were champions for 7 months and they vacated them to hold the tag team tournament and on January 3rd. And that was just simply because book company was willing to sponsor the tournament. And so they wanted the titles up for stake in the tournament. And so they vacated the titles just to win them back. So they, so they win the titles and then Masaka gets hurt and, now they got to vacate the titles again. And now Jack and Mamasaki are the champions. But so I would actually say this is the best timing that he got hurt because, they had actually kind of devalued him here in the last couple of months. He had a Corrigan match against Jun Kasai where he lost. And then he had another match in Shikiba on December 6th where he lost. So, that's the only real feud that he could have even really had at this point was against Jun Kasai, but I don't think they were going to do that because they had just done it two times in the last couple of weeks, couple months. And so I think they would have just had him be a semi-main event, tag team champion with Violento Jack, continue that for the time being until they probably lose it at a Corrigan Hall show in March or May or something like that. But, they weren't going to push him to the top. And, he's actually the only guy Freedoms has ever really created as a main event guy because he came in. I actually saw him live in, he was an Osaka guy, Osaka Indies guy prior to coming into Freedoms in 2013. I saw him June 2013 and he was opening card guy, not really established and stuff. The only thing I was at Stanley Club and the only thing I really knew of him about him was the fact that he had slept with Emi Motokawa. That was one of the bar guys at Naoshi Sano's bar was telling me. He's like, yeah, Motokawa and Masaka were a couple and stuff like that for a little while. And anyway, so that was the only thing I knew of him as. And Freedom's really built him up, pushed, in kind of the traditional way of how Japanese do it is, you lose to the top stars and big, in main events until you finally get your chance. And, he got a 11 month run with the title in 2017. He even defeated Takeda at Corrigan Hall in the main event during one of the shows. And so, they had really pushed him as a top guy, really established him finally. And Freedoms, obviously, we've talked about it, needs, to they need more new guys, and so he was a perfect fit. You know, he's really the only high flyer they have that can, you know, work that style. And so anyway, so, you know, like I said, like you know, they pushed him really hard in 2017, but in 2018 they kind of had started de-pushing him to where now he, like I said, he was just pretty much teaming with Jack in 2018. So I mean, it is a hurt. It does hurt the promotion, but I don't think it's going to crush them. But again, it's such a thin roster that, you know, just anyone, any of their top guys go down, or any, you know, I mean, even if they lose Takashi Sasaki, you know, they're not, you know, it's going to hurt them. And I wouldn't even consider Takashi Sasaki, despite running the company, you know, as a top draw or by any means, you know, a guy that's needed. But it's just the roster is so thin. And I mean, and we've talked about it, you know, they got some shows coming up here, and you know, they got a Corgan show in March, and then like March 31st, and then almost right away, May 2nd, they got another Corgan Hall show. And then they're going to have the whole, you know, Jun Kasai deathmatch tournament, or not tournament, but just series in the summer, where they run a couple of Corgan Hall shows in the summer. And then, hey, they haven't announced it yet, but they've got a big 10-month anniversary show. And I think, you know, I said, like I said, I was talking with you, I believe, where it was like they got to run something big. If they ran a Corgan Hall show for their ninth anniversary, I mean, if they, you know, and I don't think they're going to run Corgan again, because they're going to have ran Corgan in July and then August, and they got nothing booked right now besides the Shikiba show in September or October. I have to imagine they're going to run something big. I can't imagine you run a, you know, you have a 9-year anniversary show and then not have anything, you know, really lined up for a 10th anniversary. So I imagine they're going to announce something big here in the next couple months. So just the fact, like I said, that they've lost a guy that can at least semi-main event or main event if needed in Masaaka for the time being, you know, and he might be able to come back for the 10th year anniversary show as like his comeback match and stuff, but he's going to be out for a while. But, you know, like I said, Freedoms right now really can't afford to lose anybody. But as far as Masaaka's actual timing, it's probably the best timing for him to suffer this injury. Although, you know, I'm sure it's going to suck for him, because I don't think he personally, you know, I mean, obviously besides just breaking your kneecap, you know, I mean, he was making mention how he can't afford, you know, he didn't feel like he could afford the surgery, and now he's going to be out 10 months of a paycheck, pretty much.
Right.
So that's going to hurt him. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure me saying best case scenario, you know, is not, you know, looked at as very nicely, but I mean, like I said, I think right now is actually probably the best timing, but, you know, like I said, Freedoms is just so thin that it's going to hurt regardless. And we've talked about it. They need to build up some new guys and fast, or bring new guys in.
Perhaps we'll finally see that American Invasion.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. It's something's, you know, something's got to happen. Because like I said, so, you know, Jun Kasai is the champion right now. And the whole thing with Jun Kasai always is, hey, you know, he wins the title for the moment. He's not really there for the championship run and stuff. Like, they, you know, he's never had like a long run as champion, but like the, you know, he's supposed to win the title at the big Corgan Hall show at the end of the year or something like that. But then, okay, he's going to drop it here to somebody else because we don't need him as champion, you know, type thing. We only put the belt on him either to get the title off of Takeda, who's not going to job to too many Freedoms guys, or just to give him that moment, to give him the big win. You're low again.
Okay. Hear me now?
Yeah, better.
Okay. Sorry, I set my microphone down for a second. In the latter years of FMW, Jun Kasai and Ryuji Yamakawa worked some matches in FMW when they were working for Big Japan. Was there ever any plan of more of a maybe Big Japan versus FMW program?
No, what all it really was Kanemura in 99, you know, and he's loves Fuyuki, and I've gone over this on the history of MW. You know, he got a really good deal with Onita, where he got paid, I'm trying to think, I think like $100,000, something like that a year. He's making really good money. I'm drawing blank exactly how much, but anyway, he's making really good money, and, you know, and so he kept that contract with FMW up until his contract actually ended in 1999. At the end of 1999, instead of negotiating with FMW, he goes, listen, I'm going to stay with you guys, but I'm going to get paid the same amount, you know, but I'm not signing a contract. I want to be able to work Big Japan also. And so FNW allowed that as, hey, as long as you make every tour, and that's what, you know, Kanemura says, if Fuyuki told me, and again, Fuyuki and Kanemura loved Fuyuki. It was like a father figure to him pretty much. That was his boss, you know, his guy. Fuyuki says, okay, we're going to give you this deal, but if you miss one FMW show because of Big Japan, we're firing you. And you're losing all your money. And so Kanemura always made sure to make sure, you know, to keep, he never missed an FMW show. He got really banged up against Zandig in May 4th, 2001. He got really banged up in a canvas glass death match. I think it was the second match in a row or something like that in Big Japan. And then he had to fly to Kawasaki to have a big match with Mema Sasaki at Kawasaki Stadium. And he's limping and he can barely go and stuff like that. And he, you know, because he couldn't miss an FMW show because he was going to lose all, you know, he kept the good money from FMW, but he was also able to work Big Japan. So in 2000, you know, he starts working Big Japan and feuding with Yamakawa. And so the relationship pretty much was like, okay, if Kanemura's, you know, hey, if we're going to bring in Kanemura, or sorry, if, you know, we're going to let Kanemura work Big Japan and everything, we want some Big Japan guys to come in as well. So we want, you know, we want to build this Kanemura-Yamakawa feud for our May 5th, 2000 show. So that's what they did. Where Kanemura comes in to Big Japan, you know, loses the WEW Hardcore title on February 22nd. They had another match in Big Japan in April 2000, and it was to set up for Kanemura to finally defeat Yamakawa on May 5th, 2000. But, you know, and Yamakawa was such a good talent. FMW, you know, liked him and stuff. And so Yamakawa came back. He had another match with Kanemura on September 2000 at the Sapporo Green Dome. And they were a tag team. And, you know, Kanemura and Yamakawa were also teaming up at this point after the May 5th match in Big Japan and stuff. And so, you know, FNW and Yamakawa toured some more with FNW in 2001 until he ended up suffering that his pretty much his brain injury or head injury from Wife Beater in 2001. But anyway, before, and you know, so it was pretty much like, hey, Kanemura's going to Big Japan. But in return, we're going to get Yamakawa for a little while and, you know, a little bit of a feud. And then eventually Kanemura and Yamakawa are going to team up and stuff. And so it was just kind of this small deal. And then, Jun Kasai, came in 2001 and it was simply just so Kanemura could beat him, you know, so that they could have a big match or, you know, a hardcore match at the Sapporo Green Dome in May 2001. So essentially it was just, Kanemura, you know, with his relationship and everything, you know, this is allowed. And it gave, you know, Kasai and Yamakawa are going to lose, FNW, you know, against Kanemura and FNW hardcore matches. But hey, Kasai and Yamakawa are going to get paid by FNW as well to do so.
Okay. Big Japan over the years has brought in foreign talent in different waves, obviously with the pre-CZW guys, they had Mike Samples and some people, and then they had the CZW, then they had to post that with Pondo and his crew, and then, you know, for a while, there was Drake Younger and Danny Havoc, and, you know, they recently brought over the Fight Club guys and Ricky Shane Page. Freedoms really hasn't done a lot with foreign talent. Is there a reasoning why? Or they just want to keep it more Japanese, or just never built a big program with any foreigners, maybe exception of Masada, and even Masada hasn't appeared there that often.
Well, yeah, so they brought in Masada, you know, at the beginning, and they really pushed him hard. You know, they had this feud with Kasai that went 2+ years or so. So, you know, right when Freedom started, you know, they were bringing him, because Masada had this awesome match against Kamui on Christmas 2009, where Kamui and Masada pretty much brawl on top of Kamui's car, and, you know, Masada does like this Death Valley bomb on a car. It's an awesome match. If, you know, have you had the chance to see it before?
Yes.
Yeah, it's an awesome match. And so, you know, then in 2010 they had the Jun Kasai deathmatch tournament, and Masada ends up defeating Kasai early on, and, you know, and then 2011, Masato wins again, defeats Kasai, and so that sets up 2012. Kasai finally defeats Masada to win the deathmatch tournament. And, you know, at the time, it was like the biggest show, I mean, for Freedoms. You know, they drew 1,000 fans or 1,300 fans, which was a really big deal at the time, since it was such a small promotion. And so that was kind of the big thing. Like, Kasai finally gets the win over Masada. And I think they brought in Masada again. Maybe they didn't even, you know, after that, it was kind of like, okay, because they moved on to the DTU guys. And so, like, around that time period, after Kasai finally beats Masada, Kasai saw these YouTube videos of Violento Jack and Mito Extremo and stuff, and hey, you want to come in? And so Christmas 2012, so just like 3 or 4 months later, they brought in the Violento Jack and Mito, or actually at the time I think it was Arrow Boy, and you know, since then they brought in Mito Extremo and Sequel Play, and that's who their foreign talent is. They've just kind of focused on the Mexican guys and stuff instead of bringing in Masada. And one, I'm sure it's just a pay thing, a situation, like, hey, we're already paying. You know, I mean, pretty much Violento Jack has now become a full-fledged roster member where he is touring regularly. And then, you know, probably in July or so, they'll bring back the Los Nomadas. In for July and August. I think that's going to be the routine and stuff going forward. But I actually asked Masada, you know, hey, when are you going to work Freedoms again? And he was like, ask Sasaki. So he's willing to go. He's willing to tour, you know, work Freedoms. But I think at this point, they don't want to work Masada just because they already got Jack and, you know, that's their focus. And I mean, that's the guy who's full-fledged member and stuff at this point. So, as far as bringing in other guys, I think it's just simply they don't, I feel like no one's going to draw enough for them to make up for the fact that they're paying for a plane ticket.
Right. Now, early on, they booked a one-man crew for like a short tour. How did that happen?
I think that was just simply through, he was working already for smaller promotions. What's that promotion? I know Steven. Oh, Underground. He was working for Underground Chain Wrestling. He'd worked for a bunch of small other indie promotions and stuff as well. So I think it was just he was there already, and you know, in Japan. And hey, you know, I was talking about, you know, Stanley Club, being at the Stanley Club bar and stuff with Naoshi Sano, and I actually asked him about One Man Crew, and he was just like, he's crazy. He is a crazy MF-er, you know, just stuff like that. And and I don't necessarily think it was a compliment either type thing. It was like, no, he's a legitimate crazy guy. So I think it was just one of those things where, hey, you're in Japan. You want to, you know, come in for this amount of money and be willing to, you know, get your ass kicked and, you know, and have a match or so, have a couple matches and stuff. I think, you know, he worked Apache Pro. Kanemura's the smaller version of it, the Hasakawa's group in 2012, he worked. So I think it was just kind of a freelance work where, hey, you want to come in and, you know, do a death match and lose, or, you know, I forget the exact matches he was in, but I think it was just something as simple as that.
Okay. Post FMW, who do you feel has had the most success?
I would have to say Masato Tanaka, just because, you know, I mean, he's been everywhere. Noah, New Japan, I mean, had successful runs too. With New Japan, the Intercontinental title, Noah, teaming up with Takashi Segura, obviously 0-1 as a mainstay. He's worked everywhere pretty much. I would say number two, though, because I don't consider Masato Tanaka like FMW, because, you know, he left there, and I mean, no fault to his own and stuff, but, you know, him joining 0-1 so shortly after leaving FMW, you know, there's this part of me that just feels like Masato Tanaka is a 0-1 guy. You know, he was part of 0-1 before FMW closed down. So, so when you ask that question, I have to say Masato Tanaka because of a more successful career, but in my heart, I don't consider Masato Tanaka like FNW. I think the answer is Kanemura, because Kanemura was able to get booked in all those same locations, you know, I mean, and tour Big Japan regularly up until 2008. You know, he worked a very successful program in New Japan. I don't think too many people remember this at the time, you know, around this time, but, you know, I mean, he had a program against Jushin Liger and CTU, and, you know, he worked Tokyo Dome, and him and Masato Tanaka both work in Hustle and everything. And, you know, Kanemura worked 0-1 as well. And so, you know, he worked everywhere around this time period. And, you know, so I would say Kanemura. I mean, obviously, like I said, the answer is Masato Tanaka. But in my heart, I would say my heart says Kanemura, just because, hey, he was able to have a successful career outside of FMW or post-FMW as well. And it wasn't through 0-1.
What I assume Tanaka had been in FNW forever. What propelled him to jump to 0-1?
Well, he left FNW. What happened was Shoshi Arai was, you know, this was right after Hayabusa actually, and I've gone into this in the history of FNW, but I personally consider the end of FNW really was when Hayabusa got injured the first time. He ended up having double reconstructive elbow surgery, and he needed 6 months off. And that's really what, I mean, FNW died a year later, but that's really what killed FNW, because the house shows just went to hell. And they're losing money, bleeding money fast. And in February, so now after 3 months, and they're just losing money like crazy, Shoshi Arai is like, I can't, you know, I got to drop some people. I got to drop some contracts off here. And, you know, in December 2000, and I think January 2001, he wasn't able to even pay the wrestlers. So wrestlers hadn't even gotten paid for like 2 full months or something like that. I know December 2000, they didn't get paid. February 2001, it's like, oh, I'm about to not be able to afford the wrestlers again. I need to drop some contracts pretty much so that at least I can possibly get the chance of paying the other wrestlers. So Shoshi Arai calls Masato Tanaka and goes, hey, I'm going to have a meeting tomorrow. Please, you need, I'm going to say, who wants to leave FMW? Please leave. And so he asked Tanaka to leave FMW. And so the next day he holds this meeting. All the wrestlers are there, and he goes, who, you know, I'm not, I don't know if you guys are going to get paid. We're obviously struggling. Who wants to walk out? I understand. And Masato Tanaka decides, okay, I'm walking out. And as a result, you know, later Jado and Ghetto and Kaori Nakayama, who were a team with Masato Tanaka at this time period, as well as Sadiki Osaka, they all decide to walk out. Okay, we're, you know, leaving. So Tanaka left FMW, and then the problem was, yeah, he could get booked with Big Japan and stuff like that, and, you know, he worked, he did work Big Japan, but it, and he worked some 0-1 before, you know, as a freelance kind of deal, but, you know, he, in November, so this is like 9 months later, they had a show, they promoted a show, The Complete Players, and it was to help support Masato Tanaka, because he was so financially strained from just kind of working freelancer and, you know, living a lifestyle of how much he was making in FNW. And now, oh, I'm a freelancer just getting paid, you know, based off the booking and for smaller companies like Big Japan and, you know, possibly is, you know, every so often is 0-1 and stuff like that. He wasn't making great money as a freelancer. And then he had a match against Shinya Hashimoto, and Hashimoto was really impressed with him and offered him a contract with 0-1 around 2002, early 2002 or so. And so he got early 2002. And so he ended up getting a contract in 2002 with 0-1 after impressing Shinya Hashimoto. And so he was better off financially after that. But he really struggled financially for about a year or so because of leaving FMW. But again, it wasn't his real choice. It was Arai going, please leave. We are bleeding money and we can't afford you.
Okay. Right on. Let me just pull up my sheet here. on 5/5/2003, WWE brought in Shinya Hashimoto versus Kanemura and Exploding Barbed Wire. How did that happen, and how did they get Hashimoto to work that match?
Yeah, it was May 5th. May 5th, 2003. So what happened was Koto Fuyuki had cancer, and he he knew he was going to pass away. But his dream was to have he wanted to have the ultimate pro wrestling end of his life, pretty much. And he wanted an exploding barbed wire death match against Shin Hashimoto at Kawasaki Stadium. And like I said, Fuki at this point knew, you know, Fuki knew almost really early on that he was not going to live much longer. He told Hayabusa in July 2002, I only got 6 months to live. Now, granted, he lived 8 months or so, but, you know, he really didn't think he was going to live much longer after getting the news of his, he had rectal cancer. And so anyway, so around in December 2002, it was getting really bad. Like, okay, I'm dying. I know I'm going to die here soon. I want to have a match against Hashimoto. And so he set up this program against Hashimoto. There's a match, Kanemura and Hashimoto, December 29th, 2002 at 01. And Hashimoto just kicks the crap out of Kanemura. And, you know, Fuki is, you know, kind of getting involved and stuff. And Hashimoto actually kicks Fuki and everything. And it eventually leads to February 2nd, 2003. Where it's Shin Hashimoto and Tenju Kaiser, who's Kamikaze, against Tetsuhiro Kuroda and Kentaro Kanemura. And Kota Fuyuki comes out as well. And Fuyuki actually interferes in the match. He does a charging lariat on Hashimoto and stuff. And so this is the setup. They're going to have a exploding barbed wire match. Fuyuki goes, I want to die in the ring. I want to have a match against Hashimoto. And Fuyuki at this point is, like I said, really bad off. And he, you know, wants this match so badly. He wants to die in the ring. He wants this one last moment, you know, to be a part of a historic event. And, you know, nothing more historic than dying in the ring, due to how bad off he is while getting hit with exploding barbed wire. And so, anyway, fast forward to March 11th, at a WEW show, and Fuki is really bad off. He has to take a painkiller to be able to, he's living at the hospital. He has to take a painkiller to be able to get to Corrigan Hall, to be able to walk to the ring. He is sweating profusely. He is really bad. He needs Kanemura and Goito to kind of help him stand up and stuff. Like, he's that bad off. And Shin Hashimoto comes to the ring and presents him flowers and, you know, accepts the match. Okay, I'm going to have a match with you, Fuyuki. You know, this is your wish. And, you know, Fuyuki had retired and he had gotten permission, you know, by Misawa. Okay, he had a retirement match against Misawa. Or, sorry, not against Misawa. He had a match against Misawa, but then 5 days later, he had the retirement match in Noah. And so Fuyuki got permission from Misawa to lift the retirement. And, this match is good. It's good to go if Fuyuki can make it. And so, like I said, that was March 11th. And, you know, the match is announced. It's going to happen. They're shaking hands and stuff. Well, March 19th happens and Fuyuki passes away in the hospital. He only could make it 8 more days, let alone another month plus, and be able to make it to the ring. So as a result of Fuyuki passing away, they still want to have this match where it's, instead of Fuyuki, it's Kanemura, and, you know, it's kind of Kanemura with Fuyuki's spirit involved, and Fuyuki's still a part of the match in the sense of they use his urn, this big giant box, this urn, and, you know, the WEW guys bring the urn to the ring, and, there's a tin bell salute in memory of Fuyuki, and during the match, Hashimoto against Kanemura, they bring the urn into the ring, Fuyuki's urn, and Hashimoto holds it, and then he sends himself into the exploding barbed wire, and then Hashimoto then points to Kanemura, and Kanemura takes the Fuyuki urn, and he sends himself holding Fuyuki's urn into the exploding barbed wire. So it's like Fuyuki was a part of the match, even though he passed away, you know, like his spirit is there. He was involved in the match, and Hashimoto pretty much kicks the crap out of Kanemura afterwards. It's less than a 10-minute match, and, I mean, Kanemura gets some offense in, but Hashimoto just beats the crap out of him pretty much and puts him away, and so, it's a very, you know, famous match. So it's a very famous match. What'd you say?
A memorial?
Yeah, memorial. Yeah. And so it's, you know, with how just unique it was. Like, you don't see that very often in wrestling, someone's urn being involved. But, you know, that was Fuyuki. And that's what Fuyuki wanted also.
Okay. What was the reaction after Kanemaru's injury? He suffered in a work match with Mirko Crocop. I mean, obviously, that was a super severe injury. What was kind of the reaction? Should the match have been safer? Was it unsafe?
Well, it wasn't even a match. What it was
well, a run-in.
Yeah, what is running? What happened was, you know, it's a hustle show, and each like every couple of minutes, the other team would get to use a weapon. And I know it was Kanemaru and Kuroda against. I know it was Aja Kong, but I'm forgetting the other person it was with. But anyway, like every few minutes, they'd get to use a weapon. Well, the you know the 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You know, and then Mirko Krokov comes out, and it's you know Aja Kong's weapon, and essentially all it is Mirko Krokov coming in, and he gives a legitimate shoot kick to Kanemaru in the head, and that shakes his brain, and so. You know, honestly, it never, like, it was never really officially announced. The only reason I even know about it was because I was in Japan around that time period, and someone, had been at the, had been in the locker room at the, it was the New Year's Eve, it was called New Year's Eve Summit back then, at Corrigan Hall on December 31st, and earlier in the day, you know, was the Hustle Show on December 31st with the Mirko Krokop spot, and like I said, he kicked him so, Kanemaru so hard his brain shook. So Kanemaru is like, okay, whatever, I'm gonna make it to Corrigan Hall, I got another booking, I got another show, he's backstage. And he is just sitting there backstage, and he is, like the other wrestlers noticed, he's snoring and his eyes are open. Ooh, that's not... Wow. Yeah, and so, like I said, I wouldn't have even known this, but someone that worked for Zero One was there and told me about it while I was in Japan. And so, you know, I'm thinking like, oh my goodness. And I was actually supposed to meet up with Kanemaru that week. That was when I was with George Mayfield that week in Japan. One of the things was I was supposed to meet up with Kanemaru, to do like, you know, to do kind of like a meet and greet and stuff. Right. Well, that ended up getting canceled as a result. But, you know, cause you hear that and I'll go, oh my goodness. He's, you know, like he's in really bad shape. Well, he actually was at, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but there was, an old promotion called Team Vader. Do you remember that at all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So it was put on by Tomohiko Hashimoto, the Makian group, and, you know, it was a tournament and stuff. And, you know, like I said, I was going to meet up with Kanemaru for meet and greet, but that ended up not happening. But then there I see Kanemaru, and he's wrestling on the show. And, you know, he has a match and everything. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, this was just 6 days ago that he, you know, was snoring from his, you know, snoring while awake. And so, I mean, I never really heard anything as far as like, oh, you know, I can't believe that happened and stuff. But, I would have to imagine, you know, the Mirko Krokop kid was just, you know, he screwed up. He gave a legitimate shoe kick he wasn't supposed to do. But the thing was that was so that's December 31st. And I'm like I said, the Team Vader show was January 6th. 6 days later, he has a match. Well, 2 weeks later is, you know, the whole sexual harassment thing where Kanemaru comes to the locker room drunk and, you know, ends up sexually harassing a Big Japan staffer, and everything, you know, like he never works for Hustle again. Ends up, he never works for Big Japan again and stuff like that. And so, you know, by the end of the month, he's never working for Hustle again. It doesn't really matter that Mirko Krokov kicked him in the head. So, I mean, there was no real long-term effect as far as like political wise of like what, you know, can, you know, of, I can't believe this happened to Kanemaru. That's so unfair. You know, we can't let this happen. Stuff like that, you know, and cause by the end of the month, Kanemaru is public enemy number one. And the Japanese, you know, mainstream media now has picked up on this story, and Kanemaru is pretty much blackballed from wrestling for a couple months. And like, no one would touch him. So by this point, it doesn't matter that Mirko Krokop kicked him in the head so hard that his brain shook. Now, the issue with Kanemaru personally is, well, somewhere in there, it happened again. He ended up suffering a severe injury, and I don't even know the exact spot to what happened, but his brain pretty much got shook again, and he could and this is 2012. So this is 4 years later, and he could no longer have feeling in his feet and his hands. Wow. And so just really bad off, as a result. And I mean, So it's kind of strike two. And Kenimura, in the interview I did with him, said, you know, I was told if this happens again, I could die or I will die. So this was, and, you know, that pretty much, and, you know, due to just the injuries, I mean, it definitely shortened Kanemura's career. In a sense, maybe that's a good thing because of how bad off the rest of his body was. And, I mean, Kanemura is someone that needed to retire, sadly. I mean, I love Kanemura, and he could even still go when he needed to in 2014, 2 years prior to his retirement. But in 2016, his body was just completely broken down at that point because of what he was willing to do. I mean, it was, you know, everyone talks about Mick Foley and just what he was willing to do. You know, Mick Foley, the majority of his bumps and everything he did was a 10-year, you know, 10, 12, 13-year career or so. You know, Kanemura's was 26 years, twice as long, with no stopping and pretty much. And so, nice. You know, he was someone that definitely, you know, like, you know, I mean, he's walking in a cane now. It's after he retired, he needs a cane to get around. So, I mean, immediately, pretty much, you know, like a week after his retirement, he shows off that he needs to walk with a cane now. So that's how bad off he was. But anyway, so there was really no long-term effect to the Mirko Crocop thing just because of the timing. And hey, he's not in Hustle anymore because he's, you know, the worst thing ever after the sexual harassment case. Situation.
Okay. Obviously, you're very in touch with the Japanese culture. You've been over there a lot of times. Who do you think overall is the biggest foreign deathmatch wrestler who's made his impact from America in Japan?
You mean, obviously, the answer I would say is Terry Funk, but I wouldn't even really consider him a deathmatch wrestler. I mean, his popularity really comes from All Japan. And I mean, obviously, there's Mick Foley, but and he was very popular in Japan, in IWA Japan. But, you know, again, a lot of that comes from him being in ECW, WCW at the time. And now, you know, he's definitely remembered better because of WWE. As far as like, hey, they came into Japan and without really like a notoriety of fame beforehand. I mean, I was thinking about this. Honestly, I would have to say Zandig. Just how over he got in Big Japan. I mean, I was when I was doing the history of FMW, video. I was going through a match with Hito that he had 2 years after the whole CZW Big Japan thing, and I mean he is over, and the fans are eating him up. They loved him, and I mean so you know, and he obviously was the booker and made himself, you know, this famous and stuff. But I mean, I was just thinking. I mean, the only other person I was really thinking. I mean, I wouldn't consider Mike Awesome a deathmatch worker. I would say Mike Awesome was a bigger name and bigger value in Japan, especially with it being popularity being higher in the 90s and stuff. I mean, but as far as like that 99, 2000, 2001, 2000, you know, up to like 2006, you know, time period. You know, I would say Zandig was probably the most popular. I mean, the only other person I can really think of was Necro Butcher, because Necro Butcher really got over him, you know, really got himself over. And again, that wasn't through booking. You know, Zandig got himself over through the booking, making himself champion, putting himself in these main event matches and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, it worked. He got, you know, like I said, he had a popularity. There was definitely a stigma to Zandig. You know, I don't like his matches per se, but I mean, there's by no means can you say he wasn't over, or did he not have, you know, he had that ability to get over. And, you know, he had memorable matches. But, you know, like I said, Necro Butcher was also right up there. I mean, and that was, you know, he got himself over what he was willing to do. He was willing to, you know, pretty much kill himself in matches against Masato Tanaka. And I watched a match. I was there for his match against Jun Kasai. And I actually saw the only balcony spot I've ever seen at Corgan Hall was Necro Butcher diving off the balcony, and probably the least graceful balcony dive ever at Corgan Hall. Those are the top two. Because I was really thinking, I mean, I don't consider, you know, Man Pondo got over, but I wouldn't consider like his popularity even up to the Zandig level. At least, I mean, you know, me following Japan at the time, you know, Man Pondo, I just kind of considered a mid-card guy that would lose the title match if needed. The only other guy I was thinking, you know, was Masada. And, I mean, I think Masada's the only issue with Masada was that he just kind of came in a little bit later on in that, like, 2008, 2009-ish run. And I don't think I don't know. I think Big Japan had a different – wasn't willing to push Masada like they were obviously willing to let him dig, you know, earlier on. And so I think that kind of hurt Masada. But, you know, Masada definitely got himself over as well. So, I mean, like I said, just thinking about it, I think it would have to be Zandig for – like I said, I don't think he was the – you know, by any means the best worker. But I would say he probably got himself over the most in Japan for his deathmatch work.
Okay. So
who would you say, by the way? Sorry, but who do you think? Who do you
who
think?
Who would I say?
Yeah.
I gotta think about it for a minute. Briefly. Obviously Cactus Jack was over, but he really didn't he wrestled there for like a year basically.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
A long, long career in Funk. Obviously, was way over before deathmatches even started. Yeah. He was over in 1979 when him and Dory took on the Sheik and Abdullah the Butcher and became faces.
Yeah,
you know, he was like over like a gangbuster.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I guess you could say the Sheik. I mean, I wouldn't consider him deathmatch, but you know, in that same sense, you know, just kind of that brawling and stuff, the All Japan brawling of the 70s. I mean, I would consider, you know, that too as well.
Yeah. I mean, Zandig is definitely a good choice because when he was over there, he was always in the main events. I mean, his matches aren't my favorites either. Necro, I think, got over, but not to where he could have.
Yeah.
I think they kind of hindered him. He got over on his own, but he could have been huge.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have put a belt on him. So I would have to agree with Zandig because Pondo, you know, I don't feel he got over as much as he could. No one else was really there that long. I mean, you had your small cup of coffees, you know, Mike Samples and Too Tough Tony and these guys. But, you know, probably would have to be Zandig. I mean, he was doing commercials and all kinds of shit when he was over there and really haven't seen anybody else propel through that.
I don't think there ever will be unless it's just a complete culture change in Japanese wrestling.
Right. Yeah, those days are probably... But then again, they say so. More times, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you never know down the road. So where can we find you? We'll wrap up here.
You can find me at BahuFNW.com or FNWWrestling.us. I've been doing this website for 20 years. Results, biographies, got list of DVDs, news section. I just posted a news section yesterday about Onita, and I mean his knees are really bad off right now. He's looking into getting surgery and possibly even knee replacement surgery, which will probably take him out for the rest of the year, even if that is the case. But so he's really doing bad off. But you know, I cover all this stuff, all the freedoms, anything.
Do you think he'll be in GCW?
I think he's going to appear, but I don't think he's going to wrestle. It just, again, it depends on the surgery, but his knees, from what he's saying, if I'm taking him for his word and everything, his knees are really bad off. You know, the doctors told him that if he doesn't get surgery done soon, he's not going to be able, he's going to be in a wheelchair. Like that's how bad it is. Based off, you know, just him wrestling three matches where he wasn't even that, you know, mobile in the matches, obviously, but you know, I mean, I was talking about this with Steven where, you know, cause it was always like, oh, isn't Onita going to come back? Onita going to come back? And I would say, you know, I don't want to say he's not. And obviously he ended up coming back or, you know, I don't want to say he's not going to come back because he always comes back and he obviously did, but you know, his knees were really bad off in 2017 and he was, you know, turning 60 and stuff. And this was the plan for 3 years that he was going to retire at 60. And, you know, he struggled to walk up the stairs. That's how bad his knees were. So I really thought he's retiring for his own good, kind of like the Kanemura situation, obviously not as severe because it's knees instead of a brain, but you know, it was his body's breaking down. He needs to get out. And then, you know, the addiction and just missing wrestling and missing the, you know, missing everything. He decided to come back, you know, just under a year later. And, you know, like I said, just 3 months in and now his knees are really bad off again. And, you know, he's a year older and just, you know, he's going to work the Stardom Idol show and he's going to work the Baba show on February 19th. And then he said he's going to look into getting surgery and he might have to get, you know, knee replacement. And so it's going to be, a bad, you know, I mean, like I said, if he gets knee replacement, he's going to be out for a while. Now, like I said, I really do believe he will at least appear at the GCW show. And I mean, he's booked for WrestleCon, so that's an easy pay, you know, an easy gig of just, you know, taking pictures and stuff. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I mean, that obviously being on a flight that long and stuff, and even just, you know, appearing at a WrestleCon and stuff, you know, that to be just a month off of double knee replacement surgery, you know, that's even kind of touch and go type thing. But I he has said he wants to appear on those shows, still make to make it at least for those. So I mean, we'll see. But anyway, but yeah, so you can find me at that website, and then Twitter, BahuFMW. It's any type of information that comes out, I'll post about it. FMW or Onita related, any freedoms. BahuFMW World on Instagram, where I go through. I actually collected all my magazines and organized them, and I have like over 800 Japanese wrestling magazines at this point. And so I go through them and just take random pictures of FMW stuff that I see. And then Brett FMW on YouTube, where I post all the history of FMW videos in video format.
One more quick question, actually, we're thinking about this. I forgot to write it down. Thoughts on Kasai and Alice Colon?
So I don't really follow too much GCW, so I don't really know too much about Alex Colon. I know that, you know, he's the one obviously having the matches against Takeda and Masaaka, and so, you know, obviously he is, and I even knew when Kasai got announced that he was going to have the match with him, and like I said, I don't even follow GCW too much, and I knew he was going to have the match against Kasai, so obviously he's, you know, big into having the Japanese talent, and, you know, so I'm sure, you know, I heard really good positive reviews about the Masaaka match up until the injury. And so I'm sure this will be a really good match also with Kasai. So, you know, I mean, at this point, I don't know if there was anyone better even to have the match against with Kasai.
Yeah, Colon's a good safe worker, too.
Yeah.
So he's not someone I would see Kasai getting injured with.
Yeah, and you know, with the Masaaka injury, you know, we talked about it a little with the Masaaka injury, but, you know, the Freedoms really dodged a bullet with Kasai, because he had a knee injury really bad off in January. Right. You know, he ended up injuring it in November, and, you know, they were, he was getting his knee pretty much looked at and stuff, and they were draining it, and instead of water, it was blood. And they were worried, like, oh, when it's blood, this could be, like, ligament damage. And if it's ligament damage, you're going to be out for a while. But it ended up, you know, he, like, took another look at it a couple weeks later, and it was fine. And so he's back and everything. But they really dodged a bullet, you know, because I was thinking, you know, Freedoms is Takashi Sasaki and Jun Kasai. Takashi Sasaki runs the company and everything, but Jun Kasai is, like, the second man under control. And Kasai is the draw. And I was just thinking, you know, I know Steven's been asking me, do I see Kasai retiring and stuff like that? Not, you know, I mean, right now he's champion, so I don't see him retiring anytime soon. But even slowing down and stuff, the thing is, and I mean, obviously he's going to have to slow down eventually. What I worry about is I don't know if Freedoms is going to survive Kasai retiring or, you know, stepping down, because it's still a small company and it's still just really kind of based around him. And the fact that they haven't really built anyone, you know, Guts World, which granted was a smaller company, but it was a company that could run Corrigan Hall every so often, you know, Daisuke, their main guy, once he retired, they realized, we can't go without him. And they shut down a couple months later, knowing why are we going to lose money with, you know, when our top guy's gone, we never built another guy to take his spot. And I worry that would be the case for Freedoms, where if Kasai goes out, you know, just Takeda works Freedoms because Kasai works Freedoms. You know, Takeda's never joined Freedoms, but he will work whatever promotion Freedoms works, or sorry, whatever promotion Kasai works. And that's why he works Freedoms so much. But you take Kasai out, I mean, and especially if he, you know, completely ends his time and walks away from the business altogether, I don't see, you know, anyone replacing him at this point. And I mean, I won't want to say, but it would definitely shut down, but I wouldn't be surprised if it shut down. That's how, you know, how at this point Freedoms is Kasai. So
yeah, I think me and Steven were talking on Deathmatch Radio News here last night, and I think he needs to change his style up somewhat. Yeah. That splash is just, you know, maybe put him on a table or just stop doing it. you know, carve guys up, fight in the ring. But I just think that Splash is killing him. Years and years of it. And, you know, I think if he altered his style, he could probably do a slower style.
Yeah.
And last problem a couple years longer.
Problem with the Splash is that you're taking away a pop. And I know that sounds so dumb, but, you know, it's something, you know, when he does the, you know, the die chant at, you know, right before doing it, I mean, it's over. It's something that, you know, it's something that the fans love. And so it's something that he probably needs to drop. He needs to, you know, change. But he, you know, I mean, again, it's just how the wrestlers are. Wait, it's over. Why am I going to drop something that's over? I mean, it's the Muto, you know, moonsault type thing where, you
know. Yeah, but Muto didn't do the moonsault in later years as much.
Yeah.
But I mean, he only broke it out in a special match.
Yeah. And, but his knees were so bad, even, you know, his knees were. Sure. As bad as probably Kasai's are now, where, you know, obviously
maybe worse.
Yeah.
So terrible.
Yeah. So just situations like that, you know, I mean, where it's easy to say, and he should, by all means, he should stop doing it. It's just going to be harder than just saying, hey, stop it, because it's a move that's over. It's a move he's been doing for 20 plus years.
Do more tag matches, you know, do.
Yeah.
You know, obviously he does a lot of tag now, but maybe very rarely single. There's ways to make his career go a couple years longer.
The only thing is if they do have a big show at you know, wherever, Yokohama Bunkett Gym or wherever, for the 10th anniversary, you know, nothing's been announced, but I would say that is the time where things definitely need to change with Freedoms after their 10th year anniversary. Things, you know, and maybe where Kasai steps down to a lesser role or something like that. But at the same time, now you need to push someone, you need to pick up and push someone and take that spot, because, you know, like I said, Masaaka is the only guy they've ever made, and we've talked about it. Tomoya Harada, I mean, he's not ready right now. He's got potential, but, I mean, other than that, who else do they have? Dragon Libre by no means is going to replace Kasai. You know, there's really, you know, no one there that can...
Are too old and too mid-card. Yeah. They're not gonna, you know, Miyamoto and Kodoko are freelancers. They're not there that much.
Yeah, so something's going to need to change, definitely. So that's something they need to think about when you know, if they do have a 10th year anniversary show. But, you know, I mean, in the meantime, though, I would imagine Jun Kasai is going to have a, you know, like I said, it's going to be the Jun Kasai July 3rd show, and then like the August 27th, 28th show. And I'm sure he's going to main event those also and have those kind of matches, you know, until he can't.
Right. Well, definitely. Well, all right. Well, I want to thank everybody who tunes into us. I know our last episode did really well, download wise. So we appreciate you guys checking us out. You know, we kind of like to put a forum on here and bullshit about some FMW and then some newer stuff and what's going on. It's a little bit more of a free forum, and it's an enjoyable show. You can check me out at the Deathmatch Cult page. Also, the Wrestling Cult Podcast Network. We've always got new things going on there. Like I said, with Deathmatch Radio News, we're going to be doing 2 to 3 episodes a week that are shorter. And so you get to see a lot more things going on there. Steven's Bubble Project and my Combat Cult Project and future projects as we go. And we're going to hopefully have some good interviews coming up too. So thank you, everybody. And we will see you again.